Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disadvantages and disabilities who have had taken from them or have been denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those about them. We begin this week's show with a retrospective from September of 2008, the cusp of the Great Recession, with CIBC World Markets co-author Minnie Grauman. His observations will shed light on the interview that follows on food policy and prices, now and in the future. Disrespect is talking to bankers. Yes, bankers. Well, a senior economist anyway. These are not your people? I think you'd be surprised. Hear what Minnie Grauman has to say about your 2008 and 2009 on Disrespect.
Disrespect introduces Minnie Grauman, senior economist, CIBC World Markets. And we're going to talk about inflation and the poor today. Minnie, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
I read your paper that you wrote with Avery Schoenfeld, Inflation Rising Up in 2009. Are we already feeling this?
Well, to some extent, if you drive, then you're definitely feeling it.
Okay.
It's definitely the case that that gasoline prices are moving up at a prodigious pace, and that's really a function of the fact that crude oil prices are breaking new highs quite consistently. So definitely that component of inflation is definitely already here, and the question is when the other pieces of the puzzle start to come in, and we think they will.
Okay. There's some notes in the paper here about core inflation. I imagine core inflation is separate from some other kind of inflation. Can you tell us the difference?
Sure. So core inflation is really just a measure of inflation excluding typically energy and food.
Oh, really?
Actually, in Canada, the definition is a little bit different. It's a number of very volatile components of total inflation. And the idea behind that is really to get at some sort of more stable idea of where prices are going. So for a long time, this was a very useful measure, especially from the perspective of central bankers that relied on it, and it was really just a way to get rid of a lot of the volatility in sort of the main number that's usually reported and to get a more stable number.
Okay. It doesn't sound like something of much value now with the banks patching up their asset-based loan situation and everybody hurting from high gas and beginning to feel high food prices.
Right. So that's really the issue right now. We think that core inflation is dead for the time being.
Meaning what? It's dead. Dead is a useful concept?
Exactly. And it had its time. But right now, because energy prices and also food prices and other types of volatile prices are consistently moving higher, so it doesn't really make sense to talk about core inflation. Core inflation made sense when those prices, especially energy, were very volatile. So one day they'd go up and the other day they'd go down and it would sort of net out to zero.
Okay.
Now we see a continuous increase in energy prices specifically, and so it's much more useful to talk about the main inflation number.
Okay. And the picture I get is that there's a strong belief that we really are running out of oil and food.
Well, the energy dynamic is an interesting one. It's really a function of two things. One, you're definitely correct. Supply of oil is definitely lower than it was in the past. New oil production is stalling, and there are many major oil fields around the world that are basically running out of oil much quicker than many people had expected.
Really?
The other part of the equation is demand, and we know that demand has never been higher, and
yeah.
is really being pushed by the developing world, by the Chinas and Indias, and,
okay.
and their thirst for oil.
Okay. If existing fields are running out, does this indicate a past optimism, to be polite, about the capacity of existing fields? Does this indicate maybe unrealistic estimations of future reserves, or is this literally parabolic growth in consumption?
So again, you really have those two elements. On one hand, new production is not keeping pace, and
right.
on the other hand, new demand is really just flying ever higher. And part of the issue really is the fact that some oil fields are really being depleted at a much faster rate than many people had expected, and now we have new data to show that that's definitely the case. The other problem is that new supply is actually being found, but in very difficult parts of the world. So these are parts of the world that are either politically risky or the environment in which these new oil deposits are being found are very it's very difficult terrain. So what we have is the fact that in order to get at these new sources, we really have to spend much more. Oil companies have to really spend much more capital in order to get at them, making them a much more expensive barrel of oil.
Now, the classic economic relationship, and you're the economist, so correct me if I'm wrong, is that rising demand pushes up prices, rising prices signals new opportunity and funds exploration for new oil. But there seems to be a gap between the cost of recovering existing reserves and the cost of recovering new reserves, such that this flag or this signal or this push from the demand doesn't occur right away.
Well, definitely what you have is the fact that, and we see it very clearly in Canada, demand has pushed up the price of oil, and that's made development of the oil sands very attractive. And so huge amounts of capital have flowed into Alberta specifically, and that's really benefited the Canadian economy.
Mm-hmm.
But really, again, you get at the problem that the new barrel of oil, the marginal barrel of oil coming onto the world market has a much higher cost attached to it. And so that really provides, you know, just an extra support to high oil prices in general, and that's a big reason why we believe that the increase in oil prices that we're seeing right now are just not a temporary blip, but really supported by fundamentals, and this is really the way of the future. The trend is up.
And it's not driving new exploration that immediately yields new resources. We've got difficult technical problems to overcome, yes, with the new fields?
Right. That's really part of the problem. So people are, you know, are incentivized to find new sources of oil. The problem is that they're, you know, in the middle of the ocean, very deep underground, and you know, there are all kinds of technical problems associated with getting that oil. They're in very unstable places around the world, like Nigeria and places where it's very risky to station personnel. So again, the incentive is there, but the problem is that it's just much harder and much more costly to get at the remaining oil in this on this planet.
All right.
Doesn't this seem as good a time as any to introduce a break?
A tribute to Pine Top Perkins, who died Monday, March 21st, 2011, at his home in Austin, Texas. He was 97. Kidney Stew Blues.
Pretty baby, who may your love be? Want you to tell me, pretty baby, who may your love be? When I ask you that question, won't you make ranch me? Rap for me, tell me now, baby, what can I do to change your mind? Won't you What can I do to change your mind? Now you see Pine Top wearing baby and bothered all the time. Kidneys do, that old kidneys do the fine. That old kidneys do, that old kidneys do is fine. She's no hot dog baby, really got no behind. Yeah!
Your paper identifies a 3.3% rise in the price of Canadian services unchecked by imports. Is this something that is going to continue?
We think it is, and it really gets at the idea that for a long time now, really for the better part of this year, Canadian inflation has been unnaturally low, and we've really benefited from the strong appreciation of the Canadian dollar. And
it's
that's
really masked the inflation, hasn't it?
Exactly. So it's not the case that inflation doesn't exist. It's just the case that we haven't been feeling it in Canada. And the rest of the world, they have been feeling it already for quite a long time. And it's really Canada's turn now to catch up.
Okay. The story that we haven't talked much about is the rise in food prices. And again, the rising dollar has masked that. Your paper mentions a grocery store price war, so that people who have already experienced inflation in food prices may not have had to pay for it yet.
Right. If you look across the world, Canada actually has the lowest rate of food inflation among the industrialized countries. So, you know, looking at Germany, Japan, the United States, they all have higher food prices. And Canada's not unique in the sense that we're connected to those same global supply chains, those same food sources. Really, what is unique is the fact that, again, the Canadian dollar story has benefited Canadian consumers, but that's a temporary crutch. And as well, the grocery store price war, there's a lot of competition in the grocery store space in Canada. That's also helped keep prices down, but that won't last much longer because margins in that industry are razor thin.
Are we talking about three or four majors, Weston and Metro in Quebec, who now own A&P, Safeway, and Sobeys, people like that?
Walmart's the big one, right? A lot of this competitive dynamic was really triggered by the fact that Walmart came into Canada and announced that it was going to start selling groceries, and so that's been a major part of this story. But in general, you have a few large players in the grocery store space in Canada, and they've definitely been slugging it out for market share.
Yeah, so that hasn't been a bad thing up until now.
Right.
For people whose incomes are limited and they have a limited discretionary income to offset rising rents or mortgages, which involve rising fuel prices and rising food prices, what is the story for the coming months?
Well, it's definitely the case that, on an individual by individual level, there are definitely going to be a lot of people across this country that are going to feel their pocketbooks pinched. The fact that oil prices, that gasoline prices are rising by such a large percentage, definitely everyone feels that when they go to the pump, and people that spend a larger percentage of their incomes on gasoline feel that more, and in general those are maybe lower income people, but people that still have to drive quite long distances to get to their jobs. So that's definitely a very big impact, and one that impacts different people across Canada in very different ways. The fact that food prices are still quite tame in Canada is a plus, but again, when we forecast inflation over the next year, we see food prices moving up, and again, for lower income people, this is a big hit because they spend a much larger percentage of their income on food than relatively wealthier people, and so that's going to be a big impact as well in 2009.
Yeah, the impact on food prices is a triple or quadruple whammy too, because the rise in costs of transporting food go up, and even the costs of wrapping food, which is often in petroleum-based products, will go up as well.
Right, and even producing food, a lot of farms, I mean, people don't realize, but farming is a very energy-intensive business, from fertilizer, which also has oil as an input, to just the farm machinery that required to run the modern industrial farm. It's a huge extra cost for farmers.
Somebody who wants to avoid this price increase because they can't be compensated and they have nothing else to sacrifice to accommodate it, would they do better to patronize local food suppliers, given that the fuel costs are going to be lower to bring that stuff to them, and maybe packaging costs are going to be lower if it's fresher?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely an idea. I mean, it really depends on a case-by-case comparison, but definitely, I think that one thing that these types of economic challenges do bring out is people's inventiveness, and so people do find ways to try and make their dollars go a little bit farther, and that's part of the interesting thing, the interesting dynamic that you frequently arises from these types of challenging environments. If we are talking about low-income people, that the fact that the current inflation problem really is centered on energy and increasingly on food means that, unfortunately, lower-income people will get hit on the chin much harder than others.
Yeah, it's interesting that in Ontario, Dalton McGuinty has chosen this year to, quote, study, unquote, poverty, and he may get some surprising results as the year wears on and costs set a chart for the heavens. And people aren't compensated for that, of course, because their fixed incomes are, in fact, fixed. We'll see some interesting and inventive solutions from the McGuinty government when they've studied this and come up with answers for the people who are relying on fixed incomes or the working poor in Ontario.
Right, and the inflation picture definitely is quite serious, but also one has to mention that Canada is an increasingly larger exporter of energy. We have we touched upon the oil sands, and that's a very important part of the story. And what we do see in the Canadian economy is the fact that energy is providing a big boost to people, to the economy, and it does filter through to average people. If we look at the labor market in Canada now, mm-hmm. as opposed to the United States, it's much stronger than in the United States, and income growth, which is also a big positive for everyone, is above 4% on a year-over-year basis, and that's
really?
Been running at that level since the beginning of the year. So incomes are quite strong, and the employment picture is still quite good. So I think that's definitely a counterweight. In Canada, we've definitely had the benefit of the Canadian dollar to keep things masked. In the U.S.,
they have a falling dollar, so they've had a problem.
Right.
Are we going to see U.S. inflation creep across the border into Canada?
It's definitely the case that you have rising prices really across the globe, and then that doesn't provide any relief. So, during other periods where prices were falling for goods, made in China, that was providing a good counterbalance. Right now, what we see is that the prices of those goods, and it's not just because transport costs are up, but also just because China itself has an inflation problem. Those prices of those goods are also rising. So really, there's no relief from anywhere. Every country now is really experiencing a very serious inflation challenge.
Are we going to see central banks' attempts to put a crimp in this and resulting effects on employment and incomes?
Well, definitely the central banks do have to tread carefully in this type of environment.
Yeah.
And they've definitely signaled that they're very keen on making sure that inflation doesn't run wild, and they've had a good track record of ensuring that for a long time. In Canada, last week, everyone expected the central bank, the Bank of Canada, to cut rates, and they didn't. And so that was an important signal that the Bank of Canada really was maybe even more concerned with inflation than many had expected. So,
yeah.
They're definitely running, they're walking on a very thin line. We still don't think that they will raise rates this year, but the risks to the economy are still quite serious. Definitely, as we head into next year, they're going to have to start hiking rates in order to really shield the economy from the inflation problem.
So for the balance of this year, we're recovering from a slowdown, still hoping not to see a recession here or in the U.S.
Well, in the U.S., it's a little unclear. We think that there really is, some sort of mild recession in the United States. After all, they've had 5 months of job losses in a row. Their economy hasn't been hit as bad as many had expected, but they're definitely not in good shape. In Canada, we're in a little bit better shape, especially when you just look at the fact that commodity prices are really providing a big boost to corporate balance sheets, to people's incomes. Yeah,
because we are a commodity based economy.
Exactly.
Still, even in the new millennium.
we're quite optimistic about the Canadian economy, that we see the challenges to our southern neighbors being more serious than what we're experiencing here, and the fact is again that we look across economic indicators, Canada has a lot going for it, and inflation is definitely going to be a challenge, but the central bank will respond, and Canada is going to outperform the United States over the next 2 years, so that's a positive.
Okay, it's about the best we can say for now until we see more, right?
Exactly.
Okay. I really appreciate your time on the show today to talk about this with us. It's a big picture, and you've given us a big view.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Minnie.
No problem.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
You've been listening to CIVC World Markets Senior Economist Minnie Grauman talking about his paper, co-written with Avery Schoenfeld, also available on the web if you search for it under that title. inflation rising up in 2009. Now to take us into the second half of the show, social policy consultant John Stapleton. Some things have changed since our interview just on the cusp of the 2008 recession. The rise in the Canadian dollar seems to be staying there. It's masked the rise in food prices, but it won't anymore, and food buyers are going to suffer a quintuple whammy. International inflation is driving up the costs of food. Energy costs are driving up shipping. The cost of petroleum is also driving up packaging and wrapping and driving up the cost of farming, which in the modern world is largely driven by oil or mechanized farming. And for people on fixed incomes, the final whammy is that fixed incomes absorb a larger percentage of their expenditures on food. The one thing that we hadn't anticipated in the end of 2008 is shale gas. 100-year supply, it's estimated, of shale gas, which effectively puts a cap on the use of oil by providing ever cheaper supplies of natural gas from shale gas fracking, a new mining technique that's just catching on around the world. So listen to John Stapleton as he tells us what to expect for food prices against fixed incomes in 2011.
Disrespect welcomes John Stapleton, I'm the food policy consultant.
Well, actually, I work in the area of social policy, generally speaking, and along the full gamut of what that might imply.
Oh, okay. Food seems to be something you've been tagged with, then. Are you happy with that tag?
Yeah, I don't mind, because for over a year now, I've been predicting food prices are heading up in 2011, especially. And as we looked at exactly what was happening with the economy and what was happening in the United States and what was happening in the world, it started to become clearer and clearer that basic commodity prices were heading north, and that we would eventually experience price increases in Ontario and Canada. What's happened now is we're in this one of these curious pieces of time, as we were in 2007 and 2008, where the commodity prices that we normally think of as being volatile means they go up and they go down in unpredictable ways, have only gone straight up.
Right.
And because they've gone straight up now, the actual inflation of the all items index, and especially those items on their own, are traveling at levels that are far in excess of the core inflation rate. I was looking at January, and the all items index was 44% higher than core. And even though inflation, as per the announcements of Statistics Canada the other day, have actually gone down, the all items, as it compares to the core items, is still much, much higher. So there's a sense in which CPI, the consumer price index, is not an index that's really there for the consumer.
Right.
Even though it's called consumer, it's really there for the Bank of Canada to make decisions on interest rates.
So it's a tool.
Yeah, it's a tool for them. But then the other aspect, if you have other items like commodities that are going so very much traveling on a very different path than other indices, then the actual effect on the real consumer, when we think of people who are living on fixed incomes, the items that they're going to actually have to purchase, like energy, like transportation, like food, are traveling at very different levels, high above the cost of what we would call the core CPI. So we're in a very, very interesting time, because there's been other instances where they've actually tracked below that, but in this particular period, they're tracking consistently above that for approximately a year and a half.
So the consumer price index is a normally fairly broadly useful tool, but it's not meant to apply at base level to consumers, more to apply as a tool for banks and the governments to set rates. We get these anomalies from time to time where the commodities we've targeted as volatile and are excluded from the consumer price index can run below the other rates of increase of prices or above the other rates of increase of prices.
Yeah, and we happen to be in one of those periods of time when they're just like as we were in 2008, where we're tracking well above. There's really no surprise. I mean, Mr. Bernanke in the U.S. Trying to keep the United States from going out of depression. You have to remember that normally when we're coming out of a recession, interest rates are very high, trying to fight inflation, then we're trying to bring them down, and that's what causes us to go into recovery. But in this particular recession that we just had was very much like the 30s, where we had interest rates that were fairly low, and you can't take them to below zero, and there's only one other thing you can do, and it's called quantitative easing.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Bernanke did that on two occasions. So he basically, when people said, what will you do, his answer was, whatever it takes.
Yeah.
And as soon as he said, whatever it takes, it means that he's going to lower the value of the U.S. dollar. And when he does, that means the commodity prices
oh,
are going to
go up. Yeah, of course.
In U.S. terms. And that's exactly what he did. He intended to do it. I don't think it's something that we really thought about what the consequences would be. And, of course, the first consequences is that we start to look at those countries, especially in the Middle East and in the Third World, that when you have commodity prices increases, they're not insulated by the modern supply chains that we have in Canada, U.S., and the rest of the developed world. And, of course, what happens as soon as the price increases of the commodity, that's exactly what is going to be reflected in the barrow in the marketplace, so to speak.
How are we protected against these price increases? That's
we have something that's called supply chain management, and we have what's known as a supply chain squeeze.
Oh.
And so that means all the way up through the, as the person tries to sell it, the farmer sells the good at a particular, he or she is squeezed down, and that happens all the way through until we actually have it at the grocery retail level. Now, there's
You're
only so long they can squeeze when the increases in the base commodity prices goes up, and of course that's what we're going to start seeing come April, May, and June, as we start to see these prices really start to inflate. It's like an accordion. When the commodity prices go down, we don't see the prices change in the grocery store right away. It takes a long time for them to get pushed down, and then when the squeeze goes the other way, then we'll start to see them go up. And of course, we've heard George Weston company is going to increase their various foodstuffs by about 5% on April 1st.
April Fool's Day. A friend of mine said they work in retail and they work in fashion. They were kind of surprised. I said, we got some T-shirts in this year, and the prices for them were a lot higher than last year. And they were surprised. And I said, well, I heard that the price of cotton is going up. I said, but would it surprise you to know that the popularity of biofuels is reducing the land farmed for foods? And the rising price of cotton is also probably turning food lands into cotton lands. And this sea change is taking place fluidly all around the world. The price of grains going up, the price of cotton's going up, soybeans are going up. Rice, oddly, is apparently not going up that much. But
we had a real bounce in rice in 2008, and there's all sorts of different markets that apply. But cotton has hit what we might say is an all-time high, an all-time historical high quite recently.
Am I correct then that the demand to grow a crop whose price has risen to all-time high levels will also bring land that's under food production out of it too?
You know, it's really hard to say because we have a phenomenon that's been going on for a year and a half. Many people say that we're coming to the end of the commodity cycle, and it's not going to go up an awful lot further, and we're going to start to see increases in the U.S. dollar. And then there's this school of thought that says it's going to keep on rising. And I don't think at this point that anybody really knows that what we're really seeing is a long, long 18-month rise, almost interrupted in the prices of all commodities based on the U.S. decision to ease quantitatively, and
to actually reduce the value of the American dollar. Will they continue to do so? Have they reached the end of the quantitative easing cycle, and we're going to see commodities go in their many, many decade decrease that's really responsible in many ways for the higher standard of living that we have today? The commodities have continued to go down, but we're certainly in a piece of time right now where they've gone up quite dramatically.
Let's spend a few more minutes with Pinetop Perkins. Perkins, whose real first name was Willie, was born in 1913 in Belzoni, Mississippi. Piano wasn't his first choice of instrument. He started out on the guitar, but due to a misunderstanding with a woman, he was stabbed in the arm, had tendon damage, and so he switched to piano, said Bob Corator, a harmonica player who performed occasionally with Perkins and produced some of his work. This piece, Look on Yonder's Wall.
Part of the real issue, of course, is that the poor spend most of their income on items like transportation, like food, like fuel, and as a result, their exposure to the increases is much higher than it is either for the middle class or for the well-to-do.
Yeah, you mentioned that the kind of foods that lower-income people buy, highly processed foods apparently, are the ones feeling the commodity price push more than the others?
Well, they were for about a year and a half. especially those that are supply chain managed, like that are subject to board to various boards, like the
wheat,
marketing
milk,
board. So milk is very high, and we're seeing wheat the same way and meat the very same way. But at the same time, if someone can only shop at a what we would normally call a convenience store because they're not able to get to the larger grocery stores that sell the fresh fish and the fresh vegetables and the fresh fruit, but which have not increased in the same way as the packaged items that last longer.
Okay.
That would be an issue, and of course the issue of food deserts where people have to travel long distances to actually access fresh food, fresh fruit, fresh vegetables, and fresh fish. That's going to be an issue for them too. So the poor pay more in a number of different ways. Not only do they spend more money on food in percentage-wise in the first instance, they have to buy food that is more processed. And there's another whole aspect.
Why is it they have to buy food that's more processed? Because they often can't access the stores that sell fresher food.
Let's think in terms of the big four. And the big four are this: refrigeration, freezing, cooking, and storage.
Okay.
And unless you have access to safe, secure, and cost-effective, in other words, energy-efficient, storage, refrigeration, freezing, and cooking, you're not able, and you're not in a position to be able to prepare and cook and consume what we would normally think of as a healthful diet. If you have access to all those facilities, and then you have the appropriate education to make use of the of all those facilities,
right?
Then you, if you're able, then to go out to and have the transportation to travel to and obtain the types of goods that are going to provide that healthy diet, and then bring it home and prepare it, store it, confirm, and consume it, then there's no way in the world that you can possibly meet the usual standards. And so what you're going to see is that people are going to be buying those items that just tend to store longer. Now, I know that there's various food companies that are, through their canning processes, through their packaging and that sort of thing, are trying to keep items fresher longer and that sort of thing. So there is a bit of the science and technology here that comes to play here. But if you go into a corner store as we normally conceive it, you're not going to get fresh fish, you're not going to get fresh vegetables, and you're not going to get fresh fruit. Because
and the price of these packaged goods has gone up faster than the other goods.
Very much so.
Why is that?
Because I'll tell you that the fresh fruit and the fish and the vegetables are starting to catch up. Although I would say a year ago they were all tracking below inflation, now they're starting to catch up with the other items.
Okay. Why is it that the packaged goods have risen faster and higher?
Well, it just happened to be in those food groups where there is what we might call various different boards.
Okay.
And the suppliers that are managing them, like the wheat board and the milk marketing board, and all those that control the supply of those items.
An article was published in the Star recently that quoted you. Shame on me, I've forgotten the title of it. Maybe you remember it. That mentioned that the fixed incomes in Ontario, at least, have gone up about 14% since 1995. But inflation's gone up about 34%. And I think the cost of food for a welfare diet, this isn't even the supply cost, this is the retail cost, has gone up close to 54%. Now,
that's right. It sort of got away on us in some senses, because this was a welfare diet that was actually put out by the Conservative government, then Minister David DiBucci, in 1995, published what he called a welfare diet, something that a single person supposedly should be able to live on over a month, and at that time was $90, but it has since inflated to, as I cost at my local superstore, it was about $138. So it gone up by about between 53 and 54% over that time period. It's a very flawed diet, and it's certainly not what any epidemiologist would ever call a well-balanced diet.
Okay.
I think if we were to talk about a well-balanced diet right now, and that's assuming all those cooking and other facilities that I mentioned a bit earlier, as well as the food education that would allow someone to understand exactly what they need to prepare, is going to be about $260 a month at an absolute minimum.
Well,
and that's if you're really working at it.
And that's per person, right, for a single person?
Yeah.
Yeah. I would speculate then that it would be a mistake, a policy mistake, to increase those fixed incomes by 1 or 2% while costs are going up so fast.
Well, if there's an expectation that someone can live on $592 a month, the only way, which is the current amount that's set for an Ontario Works recipient, you have to remember that had those amounts increased with inflation since 1993, they'd now be at about $918 a month. So the difference between 918 and 592 is well over $300 a month.
Right.
All three different types of government in Ontario, whether it be the New Democratic Party, in their last increase to social assistance was in 1993. They didn't increase benefits in the last 2 years of their tenure. Then they were reduced 21.6% by Mr. Harris, who didn't increase them all through the period, and Mr. Eves through 1995 to 2003. And basically, I think it would be fair to say that Mr. McGuinty took the rates that he saw in 2003 has basically kept those reasonably up to date with inflation. But remember, the all items inflation, or the core inflation since 2003, but not really with the type of inflation that poor people really see. So they, once again, those amounts have eroded to the real cost of living during that period. And
so all three governments have played a shell game of a different kind with us, as far as prices and increases are concerned.
I don't know if I'd go so far as a shell game, but I would say that
Well, we've met your needs. We've met the CPI rate of inflation. If that's not a shell game, I don't know what is. Do you have a different perspective?
Well, certainly through the last 7 or 8 years, there's probably been a sense that the rates have kept pace with inflation. But what I tend to say is that we saw increases from 1935, when we first saw relief rates and what we would call welfare and then social assistance increase, till about 1993 or so, and then they've had a precipitous decline since. And so there's a real sense in which the public, the recipients of the service, those who deliver it, really see our social assistance system as an improper vehicle to deliver basic benefits. Well, there's really a crisis in terms of our sense of what we would use, the vehicle we would use to make sure that people have the necessities of life. Certainly, if we had a housing benefit that looked at the actual cost of housing in a place like Toronto, in Hamilton, in North Bay and Thunder Bay, and said, we are going to provide assistance with housing costs based on what it actually costs in those communities, which we don't do now. The same shelter component that applies in downtown Toronto also applies in the smallest rural community in Ontario. And then in that smallest rural community, it might be close to actually meeting the cost that's there. Even then, it might exceed it. But certainly in a place like Toronto, we've seen the data to tell us that most people are spending much, much more than the amount that are stipulated in the regulation. Of course, as soon as they do that, that means they're taking money out of their food and their personal needs and their clothing and that part of the allowance to meet the shelter needs, and then they don't have anything left over.
Right.
I've talked to many different Ontario Works recipients. For example, they get $592 per month, but they pay $500 in rent. They they got 90 bucks left over, if that, if they're unbanked, and the next thing you know, they spend about three days out of the month that they're able to buy groceries, and then they're heading around the various food programs and food banks, and really spending the life of a hunter gatherer for the rest of the month.
That's very perceptive. Yeah, that's how I see it too.
And we see it all the time. And if someone is not, I mean, they're not supposed to panhandle, and they're not supposed to be involved in something that's less than legal. And but in many ways, we force people into those situations, and then you know, it's like hitting them over the head and blaming them for falling.
Yeah. Well put. Do you have a favored way of looking at the solution that you want to offer to my listener?
Well, we used to have a program for that we call the welfare program for seniors, and we turned it into a modern old-age security system where we paid them a base benefit and an income-tested top-up and provided them with other various tax-related benefits. And now, you know, since 1998, we've done the same thing for children.
Okay.
And providing a basic child tax benefit and an income-tested supplement, and the provinces get involved in other ways. And we have Mr. Harper's universal child care benefit that people will have various different opinions on, but it provides a base income for kids and it provides a base income for seniors. And if we're able to do that for the bookends of our society, age speaking, then there needs to be some way that we look at working age adults who don't have alternative resources and start trying to think of a way to provide them with a base income. The whole idea of providing them with a welfare income that basically says that you can't have any more than $600 in the bank and you can't have any income from any other source, it really doesn't make sense. It's just something that keeps people in guaranteed annual poverty at a very, very low level. In many ways, it's a dysfunctional way to look at modern income security program, which really should be based on rewarding work and education and all those things and providing a basic income of sorts. I wouldn't go so far as to call it a guaranteed annual income because in many senses, what I'm suggesting wouldn't be guaranteed. It would be provided sort of a base income that you might call a guarantee, but it would be reasonably low, and then provide various different income and incentives amounts on top of that, various different tax credits and various different ways to save. I would completely remove all the assets testing that we have right now. And then maybe we'd have a real opportunity to start addressing the real needs of working age adults who are down on their luck.
Very well put. Is there anything else you would like to say about the situation today and the situation we can hope for tomorrow?
I guess the point I would make is that as we hear inflation levels being very benign right now, we should go back to the old hackneyed phrase that apparently is attributed to Wayne Gretzky, where he says, "I don't go where the puck is, but I go where it's going to be."
Okay.
And when you look at the commodity price inflation and you look where it's going to be, you can see that there's going to be major, major increases in foodstuffs coming over the next few months, and the calls for that inflation is actually very low. We're really going to have to rethink how we look at inflation, how we bring those basic commodity items into our understanding of inflation, because although Mr. Carney will make his decisions based on what the core inflation rate is, and he's probably right in doing that, the types of things that we would have to do to protect real consumers against real increases in inflation are going to be very, very different.
Thanks, John.
Well, you're quite welcome.
Okay. Well, we'll talk again.
Okay, then.
All right, good night.
Okay, bye-bye.
You've been listening to social policy consultant John Stapleton talk about the uncertainties in the future for the price of food and commodities in Canada and around the world, especially as they affect people with fixed incomes who spend most of their incomes on food and commodities. And now to take us out, Pinetop Perkins, who accompanied on the popular King Biscuit Time radio show broadcast on KFFA in Helena, Arkansas in the 1940s. Boogie Woogie King was Perkins' first solo album in 1976. Beginning in 92 with Pinetop's Boogie Woogie, he released a string of 15 albums in as many years, and here it is, Pinetop's Boogie Woogie.
There's nothing in this world that I wouldn't do. Let's go out tonight and celebrate. I got a party planned for you, darling, just one way. You my love, do most anything. Now you baby, really hope you'll be the same.
Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at Showtime to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.